The North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for a blind and print-impaired audience. John Feddersen here to read the Indie Week. And our issue today, dated May 24th of 2023, and again, we thank our musical group. I think they only sent 17 down today, and a little short from their usual 30-plus musicians. The Chamber Ensemble from the Office of Fluctuation Control and Ceiling Repair, Bureau of Soluble, Insoluble, and Indigestible Fats and Glutinous Derivatives, Washington, D.C. And they slide on out, and they'll be back to close our program. From Indie Week. Well, folks, for the first time in my short tenure here at IndieWeek.com, I went to the newsstand, and there was no new print issue for this week. And so all of these stories are now derived and from the IndieWeek.com, and that's where you can find them in detail with photographs, which might interest some of you. And musical links and many other things that we never have time to get to on this weekly broadcast. So this issue, for whatever reason, it's always leans towards Durham, and it's quite Durham heavy in articles this week. And that could be because of the News and Observer is more Raleigh based. But in any event, the first article by Jacqueline Cole, originally from the Ninth Street Journal, is about the Durham Women's Commission. A little over a decade ago, when Rube Holmes was a student at Duke's double majoring in history and African American studies, her family lived in a homeless shelter in Durham, and she visited them on weekends. She says, "My siblings were dealing with a lot with the homeless stigma." That experience is one of her many motivations for serving on the Durham County Women's Commission. In 2019, as a member, Holmes helped organize an event that helped women at the shelter her family called home just 5 years earlier. The event included panel discussions of homelessness and domestic violence. Attendees donated sanitary napkins, which were later given to women living at the shelter. It was a full circle experience for Holmes, who now chairs that commission. The group, which has a dual mission to serve the community by organizing events and advising the Durham County Board of Commissioners, has been advocating for Durham's women since its founding in 1987. An Instagram post from the group last month said, "We need equal pay now," a sentence that sounds like it could have been written in the 1980s or even earlier. Leaders of the commission say the group has always played an important role addressing the unique challenges the Durham women face. When the group was founded, the leaders aimed to keep the community informed on available resources and encourage women to advocate for themselves. The difficulties women faced in the 1980s, homelessness, lack of access to health care, and workplace discrimination, have not abated in the 21st century. Rita Denning, a new member of the group, said, "This commission needs to exist solely to bring knowledge and awareness to women. Their official mission is to educate the community and advise the Durham County Board of Commissioners as necessary on issues relating to the changing social and economic conditions of women in the county." Each year, the group focuses on three objectives. This year, these are volunteerism, community health, and financial literacy. According to Denning, the group is a buffet of diversity. The 19 women have day jobs that range from a project leader at Duke Clinical Research Institute to a statistician at RTI International. They meet monthly to discuss the quickly changing issues that women in Durham face. The subcommittees speak to the overall priorities, including Black maternal health, communications, and social justice. In addition to meetings, Leaders also organize activities and promote other organizations' events, such as a drive-through diaper giveaway organized by Diapers for Black Durham and Community Love Direct Primary Care, and a resume review session organized by NC Works. According to Tiffany Reeves, the current vice chair, the group advocates for the women and femme-presenting people of Durham County. The word woman carries a different level of complexity than it did when that commission started. Though every member of the commission is a cisgendered woman, the group aims to keep its language and mission as inclusive as possible. Reeves said in a conversation with the Ninth Street Journal, "We understand that however you choose to present, that is personal." Reeves, who was wearing an orange crew neck that read Community, said she feels strongly that continued involvement from citizens is critical to a well-functioning community. Community is a verb, she said. With a budget of $500 per year, the group does its best to advocate for its priorities. Sometimes, though, those issues don't end up at the top of the county commissioner's list. Bland says, "Our elected officials can only be focused on so many things at once." Citing issues like COVID and gun violence, Bland says she sympathizes with commissioners' need to prioritize other issues. But Holmes, who has been involved for more than 9 years now, continues to be impressed by the shared values of the county commissioners and her fellow members. When the county helped pass the Black Maternal Health Resolution, the Women's Commission initially suggested a broad maternal health proposal. According to Holmes, however, the county commissioners would not sign the resolution until it explicitly referenced Black mothers, a sentiment Holmes appreciated. Said Reeves, "There are so many different ways that you can be involved in your local government without having to necessarily be involved with capital letter P, politics." Next, another reprint from the Ninth Street Journal. Akia Dillon writes about the unsheltered homelessness. Lack of affordable housing, coupled with rising rents, appears to have worsened Durham's homelessness problem, according to an analysis by a Durham nonprofit. In a press conference Wednesday afternoon, Housing for New Hope shared the results of its annual point-in-time count, which seeks to estimate the number of people experiencing homelessness, both sheltered and unsheltered, in Durham. The count, conducted earlier this year, saw a 10% increase in unsheltered homelessness compared to last year. And just parenthetically, this is datelined May 5th, so we've held this in our folder without getting to it, for a couple of weeks now. But the results of his point-in-time count. Anyway, the result suggests that Durham City and County may need to step up services and confront deeper systemic issues for a population struggling to find stable housing in one of the country's hottest real estate markets. Russell Pierce, executive director of Housing for New Hope, said, "We are really feeling the loss of affordable housing, particularly deeply affordable housing. There needs to be more units that are publicly controlled so that we are able to address these shortages. There's funding to get folks housed in many cases, but there just are not enough units." In its survey in January, Housing for New Hope, which provides a host of social services in Durham, found the total number of people experiencing homelessness had dropped by 18%, 459 to 375. Yet the number of unsheltered people rose for the third straight year, 105% increase since 2020. In particular, Pierce said the nonprofit is concerned about the number of families with children living in unsheltered conditions. That's a trend the group first saw in 2021. This year's survey discovered 10 such families who lived unsheltered. Moreover, African Americans comprise a majority of both sheltered and unsheltered populations. This year, 68% of individuals experiencing homelessness were black, according to 2020 census data. Black people make up about 36% of Durham's population. Dramatic hikes in both rents and housing prices are making life harder for the homeless. In May of 2018, the average apartment rental price in Durham Chapel Hill was $1,034. By May of 2022, this figure had jumped to $1,370. And the buying market in Durham reflects similar trends. In 2018, the median listing price for a single-family home was about $250,000. Today, 5 years later, the prices have skyrocketed to about $415,000. Colin Davis, who manages the City of Durham's efforts to curb homelessness, said the COVID pandemic and the ensuing mental health and eviction crisis may also explain the PIT trends. City Council member Leonardo Williams and County Commissioner Wendy Jacobs both attended the Wednesday press conference. Williams said the city intended to be, quote, as ambitious as possible in creating more affordable housing in Durham. He referenced recent projects such as the Willard Street Apartments and the Joyce residences that offer more than 160 affordable units combined. Jacobs spoke to county efforts, such as redeveloping affordable units at 300 East Main Street and creating more educational opportunities and jobs for traditionally underserved populations. Nevertheless, Jacobs said the county must do more. Durham has done little to assist its most vulnerable unhoused residents, those who experience chronic homelessness and mental disabling conditions like mental illness or substance abuse disorder, she said. Quote, we have a revolving door that goes from our emergency department to our jail to our shelters to the streets and then repeat, all because they are not able to get the kind of health care that they need. Jacobs pointed out that Housing for New Hope is seeking funding for a project at 501 and 531 on East Carver Street that would ultimately provide about 120 affordable housing units and on-site support services for vulnerable residents. The County Commission is considering the request. Now, this annual point-in-time count took place on the night of January 25th. Housing for New Hope intentionally surveys during the coldest time of the year because unhoused individuals who still have connections to family members or friends are more likely to be taken in when cold and wet weather comes, Pierce said. By surveying in the winter, Housing for New Hope can make the most accurate estimate of those experiencing homelessness. Each year's count includes people staying in emergency shelters or transitional housing and unsheltered people living in places such as cars, stairways, commercial buildings, and more. This year, 150 volunteers canvassed specific areas throughout the county and city, including encampment sites on Holloway and Roxborough Streets and parts of downtown that are known to attract transients. And this year's volunteers included Mayor Elaine O'Neill and Jacobs. Now, another 9th Street Journal reprint by Audrey Patterson again about Durham Council. Durham Council signals support for major affordable housing proposal. Durham's affordable housing efforts got a boost last Thursday as City Council members voiced support for a $6 million project that would preserve and develop over 100 residences. At a council work session, the nonprofit Housing for New Hope, HNH, asked the city for over $3 million, and five of six members present showed enthusiasm for the proposal. That $3 million would go with another $3 million already approved by the county commissioners in early May. The commissioner's commitment is contingent on the city council's official approval of the project. City officials have repeatedly said that affordable housing is a top priority as rents and home prices have skyrocketed in recent years, boxing out scores of Durhamites, many of whom have decided to relocate. A 2023 North Carolina Housing Coalition report found 48% of Durham renters had, quote, difficulty affording their homes. Earlier this year, HNH estimated that the city's unsheltered population, that's homeless people who live in places like cars, stairways, and commercial buildings, has increased 10% over last year. But as that population grows, Russell Pierce said, and he's the HNH executive director, we are losing more units across the state, from what we understand, than we are constructing. Pierce stressed the need for deeply affordable supportive housing that provides resources to combat conditions often faced by people experiencing chronic homelessness, such as substance use disorders and mental health challenges. HNH already oversees two such communities in Durham. By acquiring 531 East Carver Street, HNH would be able to develop and preserve 100 to 120 units of supportive housing. The location next to another HNH property would accommodate 45 of those new units. Well, at the work session, Mayor Elaine O'Neill asked, where would that money come from? City Manager Wanda Page responded that Durham's affordable housing project budget, quote, would not be able to cover something of this magnitude. The $3 million plus would have to come from the city savings. And Mayor O'Neill said, I do think that we can justify going into our savings. This does fall into a unique category for our most vulnerable and marginalized community members. While the overall $6 million request would cover only the buying price of the land, HNH mentioned other partners, including Alliance Health, Duke University, and Duke Health, that are interested in financially supporting the development of the units and services. Currently, that property is under contract with HNH and has a projected closing date of June the 28th. The acquisition of a Carver Creek would not only allow for 45 new units, it would also keep the current tenants housed. In 2024, that Carver Creek complex, which serves low-income residents, will be at its 30-year expiration of protections, meaning that a private developer can buy the property. Pierce noted that of today's residents, 60% are on government subsidies and would likely struggle to find new affordable housing. As it turns out, other publicly funded properties could also be reaching the end of their protections. And Council Member Jillian Johnson said, it's kind of scary that there might be a bunch of other buildings out there that we don't know about that we might lose, and that we've got folks living in that we want to make sure we can continue to house. Pierce said, we really do look forward to partnering, not just in the development of Carver Creek campus, but also to help so that we as a community can have a plan to address the potential loss of other properties. At the work session, representatives of several key organizations voiced their support for the Carver Creek acquisition. That And organizations included Chefs for Change, the Criminal Justice Resource Center, Durham CAN, Durham Congregation and Action, and Urban Ministries. Jeremy Bergman from CAN, who identifies as a low-income disabled veteran, said, I have a pretty good life now. The biggest factor is that I live in affordable housing, and I have been able to access mental health services. Along with O'Neill, council members Leonardo Williams, Mark Anthony Middleton, Javiera Caballero, and Monique Holsey-Hyman expressed their support for the project and urged other community stakeholders to get involved. Between May of 2018 and May of 2022, the average rents in Durham Chapel Hill surged about 25%. And in that same period, median purchasing prices for Durham houses soared about 40%. Meanwhile, the number of unsheltered people in Durham has increased 105% over the last 3 years. Williams said, "I think this is an opportunity for us to engage the broader community, to be players in solving this crisis. There are a lot of folks that are sitting in the audience or on the sidelines watching them, and I challenge them publicly to get in the game." Next, Nina Musk from the 9th Street Journal. This was issued on May the 1st, and we haven't read it here yet. Bike boulevards bring hope to Durham cyclists. In a rare win for Durham's cycling community, the City Transportation Department will roll out two long-awaited projects in the coming months. 8 new miles of bike lanes will be installed around the Bull City this summer, following the creation of neighborhood bike routes this spring. These routes, known as bike boulevards, will give cyclists travel priority on select Durham roads. Now, bike boulevards are slow, low-traffic streets with signs and pavement markings to help cyclists navigate more safely. Speed management measures like traffic circles will be built to discourage car traffic. With input from community members and advocacy groups like Durham Bicycle Boulevards, the Transportation Department picked routes for the first phase of the project back in 2018. After years of planning, 7 miles of boulevards will be marked within a 1.5 mile radius of downtown Durham this spring, and these include portions of Watts Street, Arnett Avenue, and Glendale Avenue. Bike symbols with arrows will be painted along the routes every few blocks. A flyer for this project says that major intersections will also be improved, but doesn't specify how. Now, I'll just add that the online IndyWeek.com includes maps of these boulevards available also from the city of Durham. Now, Aaron Convery, 32, transportation planning manager for the city of Durham, says more bike boulevards will follow. Quote, "The idea was to start with a somewhat connected network in the center of Durham that tied into some of our other existing bike facilities and expand the network outward in later phases of the project," she said. The department has federal funding to expand the project beyond downtown Durham and aims to begin planning later this year. Convery says the transportation network, quote, "is trying to build out a safer, more connected bike network and provide options that are comfortable for people of all ages and abilities." While Durham is years away from a citywide cycling network, the Transportation Department plans to install more bike safety measures in the coming months. In addition to those bike routes and new bike lanes, the department will improve protection for existing bike lanes on some of the city's busiest streets. John Talmadge, who is the executive director of Bike Durham, that's an advocacy organization, thinks the bike route project pedals Durham closer to a safer future for cyclists. He told the 9th Street Journal, "We're supportive of these bike routes as a small component of building out a citywide protected bike network. We're happy this is being done, but it shouldn't end here. Without comprehensive safety measures for cyclists, Durham has seen many bike-related accidents in recent years. Talmadge said the speed of vehicles and a lack of protection for cyclists are some of the most pressing concerns. For now, Convery says, the neighborhood bike routes provide an option for folks who maybe aren't comfortable biking on some of the more major roadways. Talmadge hopes the city will not stop there, saying, you need physically protected bicycle lanes, you need slow streets, and you need separated trails all working together to create a network throughout the city so that anybody at any skill level at all different ages can get where they want on their bikes. The city is slowly moving in that direction, but we want them to move much, much faster. And as I search around for more Durham-related articles, this one pops out at me from the Eno River people. And it's written by Hannah Kaufman. Emily Hill, director of development at the Eno River Association, said, it's not every day a big public park opens, so we're excited to be able to welcome folks out to Panther Branch. In early April, the nonprofit officially opened new park Panther Branch Natural Area to the public. Located at 2437 Lebanon Road, 3 miles off of I-85 and I-40, the park includes over 2 miles of walking trails through 56 acres of forest, with opportunities for hiking, fishing, and picnicking. The park is open from dawn to dusk 7 days a week and has on-site gravel parking. At the park's grand opening just a little while ago, May 18th, local musicians Charlie Garnett and Michael DeVito strummed folk music as visitors milled around the entrance, sipping blueberry wheat beer. As the final guitar notes faded out, leaders from the Eno River Association spoke about the work that had gone into opening the park, highlighting the wealth of natural resources that the public would soon get to experience for themselves. The association first acquired the land in 2017. 600 hours of volunteer work clearing bushes and forming trails later, the park is finally open to the public. It's the nonprofit's first footprint in Eflund. What sets Panther Branch apart from other properties around the river, according to Hill, is that it is almost completely untouched by human activity. Hill says it's pretty pristine right now, and we're really excited about that because that means that there's big fields of trout lilies, lots of native plants, intact hardwood forest, and several creeks that have creek crossings. Panther Branch is home to two main trails. The trail names, chosen from a contest of over 200 submissions, were announced last week, and they are Spoonwood and Running Cedar. The Spoonwood Loop is a moderate to easy 1.2-mile hike, while the Running Cedar Loop an easy 1-mile trek. Along the trails, hikers can find wildflowers, bird sounds, creeks, beaver dams, small reptiles, and an overlook of the Eno River Bend, one of the river's most dramatic views. The park's opening goes hand-in-hand with the state's 2023 Year of the Trail campaign, a celebration of nature that promotes outdoor events and connects residents with North Carolina's thousands of miles of trails and greenways. State organizations aren't the only one promoting the outdoors this summer. North Carolina's weather seems to be playing a part in the celebration, too, with a recent climate update finding the entire state is now drought-free for the first time in 2 years. According to the North Carolina Drought Management Advisory Council, heavy showers in April have led to clear drought map in all 100 counties. And Hill says with good weather and blooming plants on their side, the Eno River Association hopes Panther Branch will become a go-to hiking spot for locals. Over to Orange County, Chapel Hill, and University of North Carolina, see Chapel Hill, their controversial new school. This was originally a story in NC Newsline, written by Joe Killian. Now that the academic year has ended, UNC Chapel Hill leaders are sharing more information about the new and controversial School of Civic Life and Leadership with faculty, who thus far have questioned and opposed its creation. This includes additional details about the school's creation, the hiring of faculty, and the formation of a curriculum. In a letter to faculty this week, Jim White, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, acknowledged the push from the legislature and its political appointees to create the school, one of several recent legislative reaches into what is taught and how at schools in the system that has caused widespread discomfort among faculty. White addressed both the new school and a new and unrelated Communication Beyond Carolina requirement, which emphasizes communicating to different audiences. This new school may play some part in teaching classes to meet that requirement, White wrote, and he supports the stated ethos behind both. He wrote, I know the School of Civic Life and Leadership was launched in a way that concerned many faculties, but the foundational idea behind both the school and the Come Beyond requirement to better equip our students with the skills needed to engage in public discourse and thus to better prepare them to be stewards and citizen owners of our shared democracy was an idea that our faculty had when including Communication Beyond Carolina in the new Ideas in Action curriculum. The new school, which has been in the planning stages for years, has been described by some of its architects, supporters, and political appointees on the UNC Board of Governors as variously as a conservative center for UNC Chapel Hill and an attempt to level the playing field at a university they believe is ideologically dominated by the political left. It has been strongly opposed by students, faculty, and alumni who object to both those aims and the process by which it has been outside of the usual campus-based, faculty-led process for creating a new school. White wrote, I heartily embrace that idea and encourage us to own the school, make it a national model for public discourse and civic engagement, and ultimately make it uniquely Carolina. Civil discourse is a commodity in short supply today, yet is essential to a well-working democracy. Many universities and colleges are currently exploring how to address this problem. Let us lead the way. In January, the UNC Chapel Hill Board of Trustees, whose members are political appointees of the legislature's Republican majority, passed a resolution to accelerate the creation of the school. Under the state's Senate's version of the state budget, the School of Civic Life and Leadership would be officially established and receive $2 million in each of the next two fiscal years. That matches the state's House budget proposal. Both chambers' proposals fall short of the $5 million in state funds anticipated in a school planning document drafted by UNC Chapel Hill Provost Chris Clemens. The provost plan anticipated state funding would be matched by unnamed private donors. With or without the private match, the House and Senate budget bills say if state funding is insufficient to establish the school, the university itself shall expend sufficient additional funds to achieve that purpose. In his letter to faculty, White announced an ad hoc committee charged with working out the details of the school. White will chair that committee himself. And there is a list of other members, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, members from the professors, associate deans from various schools at UNC. The proposed school continues to generate strong opposition from faculty, with some departing members citing it as political overreach into the university system that helped to drive them to other opportunities. In an open letter decrying a slate of higher education-related bills this legislative session, the state chapter of the American Association of University Professors, the AAUP, called the school's creation part of a war on higher education in our state. This initiative, the group wrote, reflecting board members' claimed desire for greater partisan balance among the professoriate, came from board members rather than faculty. It's a clear violation of the AAUP principle that faculty should shape curriculum and those aspects of student life which relate to the educational process. That is per the AAUP Statement on Government of Colleges and Universities. The next story by Ben McNeely appears in Indie Week. It is originally published at NC Health News. The gift of a sun catcher became a symbol of hope as local and federal officials gathered with hospital executives at Garner Town Hall in southern Wake County to announce the awarding of $12 million in funding to help build a new mental health facility. Rachel Moorfield was in the audience. In 2018, her son Isaac died by suicide at the age of 19. Her family, through their grief, made sun catchers as a way to remember Isaac and his sunny personality. She brought one to the announcement ceremony to symbolize and celebrate support for the cause of mental health care. Moorfield, who recently moved to North Carolina from Minnesota, said having access to compassionate care is essential for people dealing with mental health issues. Compassion, she said, is something that Isaac did not receive, as she and her family looked for the help he needed to treat his depression. And she said, the problems we ran into was, one, getting him admitted and feeling like he was in a prison, feeling like it was in the basement. The psychiatric unit was tucked into a corner. They were wearing brown garb. There were locks on the doors, and there wasn't any feeling of hope for him. It just felt like, here you are, and here we're going to keep you and then send you on your way. Now, Wake Med is aiming to change the way mental health care is delivered with a new campus in the state's largest county. The Raleigh-based systems plan is to build two facilities in Garner, a 45-bed acute care hospital and a 150-bed mental health and wellness hospital at a campus near White Oak Road and Timber Drive East, an area that has seen explosive growth in the past few years. On Friday, the health system announced a $12 million in government funding toward the new mental health hospital, with Wake County chipping in $6 million and the federal government the other $6 million. United States Representative Deborah Ross and recently retired U.S. Rep. David Price attended the announcement. They had championed the money through the appropriations progress in Congress. The appropriations process in Congress. The whole goal of the new hospital is to integrate mental and physical health services into whole person treatment, said Donald Ginzig, Wake Med president and CEO. Quote, we wanted it in the county. We didn't want it isolated somewhere. We already planned to put an acute care hospital here, and so why not be bold and innovative around that whole person concept? The National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health says, quote, whole person health focuses on restoring health, promoting resilience, and preventing diseases across a lifespan instead of treating one specific disease at a time. Ginzig said that in the past, health systems treated mental health differently, and in some cases didn't address it at all. But the pandemic exacerbated existing problems, resulting in a rise in drug overdoses, depression, and anxiety. People went to emergency room for help, creating a problem that health systems have struggled to address. Ginzburg said, I think for years it was like, well, if we just don't look, it'll go away. We don't talk about it, it doesn't exist. Let's focus on heart disease and all the other things that are important. But we also know that it didn't go away, and it's not going to go away. The health campus is part of a larger mixed-use development being planned by the town of Garner, focused on wellness and innovation. The mayor, Ken Marshburn, said, this mental health and well-being hospital, along with an acute care hospital, to be located on the same site will provide Garner, our town, and surrounding counties with easier access and enhanced care. That will be a huge benefit for our growing area. Construction on WakeMed's $137 million mental health hospital is expected to begin next year, with a potential opening in the fall of 2026. WakeMed also received the go-ahead from the state for the acute care hospital, but Duke Health, UNC Health, and Oakview ASC, a limited liability corporation based out of Elizabeth City, are appealing that decision. WakeMed said they are confident the decision will be upheld. This facility in Garner is just the latest in a trend of healthcare systems establishing freestanding mental health facilities across the state. From April of 2022 to April of 2023, the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services issued certificates of need for 5 mental facilities in Brunswick, Pitt, Richmond, Wake, and Sampson counties. The planned campus comes as Wake County's partnership with UNC Health to run the mental health facility at Wake Brook is under a cloud of uncertainty. UNC Health has been running the facility since the 2012 agreement. The facility, which has been open since 2010, has garnered national attention for its innovative programs that provide comprehensive care for patients, including outpatient, inpatient, and substance use care. The county's current contract for inpatient and crisis care with UNC Health ends in November of 2024, while UNC Health said it will end other services near the end of this year. Shanika Thomas, chairwoman of the Wake County Board of Commissioners, said the county is still negotiating with UNC Health to provide services at Wake Brook after UNC Health said they were leaving. Thomas said, if not, then we will be searching for another provider to provide services, so we don't anticipate that there will be a gap. Now, the grant announcement also comes as Wake County has seen a jump in the number of emergency room visits for mental health concerns. Thomas said a recent study commissioned by Wake County reported that 3 hospital systems in the county saw a 40% bump in the number of encounters with primarily a mental health diagnosis between 2018 and 2022. That same study also recommended keeping Wake Brook as a hub for mental health crisis assessments. And Thomas said the critical need for a campus like this is clearer now than ever. That's thousands more people who desperately need the right mental health care. In Garner, WakeMed plans a different kind of mental health hospital, one that is built around the whole person model of treatment. Dr. Micah Krampaski, WakeMed's chief medical officer of health and well-being, writes, our mental health hospital is going to be the crowning jewel of this campus, not the mental health hospital in the past, not like the traditional psychiatric units in America that are hidden in the corner with poor visibility and poor accessibility. Krampaski said at the grant announcement ceremony that the plans for the new mental health hospital include a gym to promote exercise, a dining area to promote healthy eating, and outdoor space to promote the healing effects of nature. She said it's going to proudly sit next to a big acute care hospital, and it's going to unabashedly welcome people into its doors and celebrate the beauty of helping and supporting mental health. Grompaski held up a sun catcher that Moorfield had made as a symbol of hope and as a gift to the officials who had helped secure the grants. Moorfield said, "It's so wonderful to hear what Wake Med is doing, because we're letting people know that they are not a burden. They're not a burden to the healthcare system. They're not a burden to the community, and we're here to help them and get them the help that they deserve." And that's huge. It's huge. All right, let's take ourselves over to the cultural columns in Indie Week. And Peggy Chen has written this. Local dance groups connect Chinese-American youth with traditional culture. Like many high school students, Anna Jing has a busy schedule of calculus homework, SAT prep, and planning summer beach trips with friends. But the way she spends her Sundays is a bit different, leading over 30 dancers, some as young as 8 years old, through the Chinese folk dance routine. The troupe, named Ruby Slippers Chinese Dance Club, rehearses at a Carrie-based dance studio tucked into a nondescript strip of small business. Under fluorescent lights, floor-to-ceiling mirrors reflect an entourage of teenagers, most of Chinese-American heritage, moving in sync with the lulling melodies of flutes, cymbals, lulling melodies of cymbal, and strings. The elegant music echoes through the rest of the building, relatively empty on an early weekend morning, with the occasional straggler catching a glimpse of the dancer's routine from the hallway. Zhang says, "Ruby Slippers has a big connection to my culture. Ruby Slippers is a real tie between my identity as a Chinese person as well as my love for dance." The high school junior serves as president of the Ruby Slippers Chinese Dance Club, a non-profit affiliate of the Raleigh Academy of Chinese Language, a local language school. Founded by 10 passionate dancers in 2006, the club has since expanded to form two performance troupes of over 30 members. Unlike in most dance programs, students are the primary leaders of the club. Zheng is an instructor, alongside a student board of 11 other high school dancers who teach and mentor younger students. They develop choreography, organize performances, and collaborate with local organizations. Zheng says the club's tight-knit community has helped it thrive over the years. Quote, "The people who have graduated and were teachers are just like part of the club. We're still connected. There's a real sense of connection between everybody because it's not just like a teacher telling you what to do. We're student leaders, so everybody has a way to express their individuality." Ruby Slippers is a testament to the thriving and burgeoning arts scene within the Triangle's Chinese-American diaspora, with a handful of local organizations tailoring Chinese traditional dance to performers of all ages. Carrie Chinese School, an organization similar to the Raleigh Academy of Chinese Language, offers classes in Chinese dance for elementary school-aged dancers. Teenagers on the NC Youth Performing Team perform folk dances at local cultural events across Wake County. Triangle Chinese Dance Club, mostly composed of middle-aged dancers, many of whom are parents, is an outlet for dancers who still hold an affinity for the art form. The popularity is, in part, due to the steadily increasing Chinese-American population, with a recent joint study between UNC Chapel Hill's Asian American Center and Carolina Demography indicating the statewide Asian population grew by 64% between 2010 and 2020. Duke University's Chinese dance representative James Liao describing the range of backgrounds the club members hail from. Quote, this past year, we had a record number of prospective dancers at our annual auditions. I think this shows that Chinese dance is popular among the youth. Some of our dancers had years of dance experience before coming to Duke. However, many also did not come from any dance background and decided to join our group to learn. Many dances that these groups perform center around narratives inspired by traditional Chinese folklore that depict ancient legends or mythical creatures. Zheng says, there's always intention behind every movement, even down to your fingertips. Despite its deep roots in Chinese history, the form only began appearing in official dance curricula in China during the 1950s. Chinese immigrants would later bring the dance to the United States, teaching dances to family and friends during parties or celebrations. Now it offers Chinese American youth a chance to reconnect with their heritage. Chir Pan, co-founding of the Pan America Chinese Dance Alliance, PACDA, says, I always say Chinese dance is one of the best ways to introduce Chinese culture and history to people. A lot of people only consider ballet and modern dances serious forms of dance. And Chinese dance is just as valuable and takes as much effort and training. Pan was born into a family of dance educators, and both her parents serve as instructors at the Beijing Dance Academy. PACDA promotes Chinese dance education and cross-cultural learning for younger generations of dancers and hosts competitions that youth dance clubs like Ruby Slippers can participate in. These competitions bring together dance troupes and programs across the country and allow young dancers to improve upon their practice. They also serve as opportunities to spark curiosity about Chinese culture. But regardless of whether young dancers choose to pursue the art from beyond high school, the art form beyond high school, Pan believes in its importance increasing visibility for Asian American culture and in diversifying mainstream dance. She says it's important to send a message that there's not just one form of beauty. Zheng has a similar attitude and says she sees Ruby Slippers dancers as cultural ambassadors in the community. Recently, the group performed at Carrie's Taste of China Festival, an affiliate of the Chinese American Friendship Association of North Carolina, and hosted a booth selling baked goods and sharing information about Chinese culture. She said, what we do in dancing, as well as what we do as a group, is a way to educate people about how Chinese culture is. Reflecting on her journey from a young age, she found it is the community of fellow Chinese American dancers she is most grateful for, saying, I'm really appreciative of the opportunities it's given me and has raised me as a leader. It has been a community. Now, our next article from the musical section of Indie Week is about the Hopscotch Festival, which is bigger than ever this year, and that will happen around September. But because of the number of acts and the publicity that it brings to the musical scene, I'm going to read it. And Sarah Edwards has written this one as of May the 19th. Sorry, I have a lot of tabs open. Nathan Price apologizes. It's 2 days before the Hopscotch Festival 2023 lineup goes live. Over the phone, the festival director is describing the tenor of the event as he clicks through spreadsheets of the 80-something bands finalized, some who have signed on just this week. It runs September 7th through 9th this year. The ambitious lineup, which went live Friday at noon, includes Japanese Breakfast, American Football, Cool Keith, King Cruel, Tia Corrine, Dinosaur Jr., Denzel Curry, Margot Price, Cut Worms, All Vase, Lola Kirk, and Soccer Mommy. Price says that he expects to have more than 100 bands confirmed by September. Also confirmed, Pavement, which Price describes as the festival's biggest get ever. Since 2010, Hopscotch has drawn crowds from across the Southeast with its dynamic blend of burgeoning indie rock acts and homegrown hip-hop talent, including the likes of Solange, Run the Jewels, Erykah Badu, Beach House, James Blake, Vince Staples, The Flaming Lips, and St. Vincent. Resisting the siren call of influencer step and repeats, and a maze of sponsored tents that often signify contemporary festivals, Hopscotch has maintained the identity of an event firmly rooted in its home city and created for people who love live music. The inaugural year boasted 130 acts spread across 10 Raleigh venues. Last year, tempered by the pandemic and recovering music industry, they hosted just over 30 bands and a much smaller crowd. Price says this will be the first one that's back to normal with the pre-pandemic level of bands, and we're doing indoor clubs. COVID hit us bad the last 2 years, obviously, for different reasons. During the years that Hopscotch has worked to regain its footing, the city of Raleigh has found another event to anchor its musical reputation, J. Cole's Dreamville Festival, which held its first festival in 2019 at Dorothea Dix Park, paused in 20 and 21, and returned with aplomb in 22 and 3, drawing stars like Usher, Summer Walker, and Drake to the stage this past spring and reportedly selling 100,000 tickets. In 22, it created a $6.7 million impact in Wake County, according to the Convention and Visitors Bureau. The Hopscotch economic footprint may not be as big, but it too has consistently bolstered business and downtown life every September and secured Raleigh's reputation as a music destination. It is has a burnished reputation for elevating local acts, and this year is no different, with performances from Angie Meal, Rosalie, Cheserich, Truth Club, Larry and Joe, Pat Jr., Skylar Gudash, and many more. And comedy is added to the bill for the first time ever, with a set by SNL frequenter Sarah Sherman, known professionally as Sarah Squirm, and Whitmer Thomas, who will also perform music with his band. Well, there's my inflatable airbag telling me to stop before I hit the wall of airtime. John Federson for the Indie Week saying so long. We'll be back next week with our next issue. And it can be found at ncreadingservice.org if you need a repeat of the in our podcast section. So long now, everybody.